This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan with me, Brian Fernandez and Tan Chung Han with the top business stories of the day. We have quite a number of stories to get through, Sime Darby, Samsung and 1MDB. But before we get to the story that keeps on giving, i.e. 1MDB, we'll go to Sime Darby. Recently, of course, they announced a demerger plans. For people who have enough history in their pockets, they'll remember the merger plans. And recently on Pressing Matters, we had Pete Gunasekaran talk about the question of the merger as well as the demerger and the logic behind such exercises. Now, Brian, what do we have in terms of the latest movements on those demerger plans?
So basically, Sime Darby is to be broken up into three different entities. There's going to be Sime Darby itself, the main company. Then you would have the plantation division, which would be a separate company on its own. And you will also then have the property division. Now, Tan Sri Dr. Wan Abdul Aziz Wan Abdullah will be appointed as the new chairman of Sime Darby itself. And the new CEO and president, group CEO and president, will be Jeffrey Salim Davidson, who is an internal who gets an internal promotion. For the plantations business itself, the chairman will be Tan Sri Abdul Ghani Othman, while Tan Sri Bake Saleh will move and take charge of Sime Darby Plantations as executive deputy chairman and managing director. If you look at his background, he is actually a plantations man. The existing CEO, Dato' Frankie Anthony Das, will remain as chief advisor and value officer. And the CFO, Renika Ramachandran, will remain. For Sime Darby Properties itself, and this is a very interesting development, Tan Sri Abdul Wahid Omar, the chairman of PNB, will be chairman of Sime Darby Property, and the managing director will be Dato' Sri Amran Abaluddin, who's the former CEO of Media Premier.
Yeah, so it's Amrin Abaluddin.
Amrin, yes. So what does this all mean?
Yes, what's interesting, of course, is that if you kind of go back in time to the merger, you'll ask yourself, why merge? And then now we have a demerger process. So how do we square the rationale behind the merger now and the demerger? Sorry, the merger then and the demerger
now. Okay, let's look at, if you look at the baseline case for the merger, it was basically merging three big plantation companies together to have one large plantation company.
So economies of scale, contiguity of the land holdings, all these things, right?
Absolutely. And to some extent, that was achieved within the plantation business itself. But obviously, what's happened in the interim is the following. Return on shareholder equity has declined for the group tremendously. Now, in 2012, you were talking about 17.6% return on shareholder equity. In 2016, it was only 7.6%. Mm. So really significant decline. So in other words, what's happening is the operating businesses have become obviously less efficient. Mm. Now, the second thing about that is also the fact that by a lot of times the market sometimes discounts, there's a conglomerate discount attached to it. And so by splitting the company up, you will be able to unlock more value in terms of capital appreciation of the share price. Now, Sime Darby's share price itself has essentially stagnated over the last 3 years. You will also have potentially improved dividend payout capabilities. What will probably happen as part of this demerger is also some unprofitable businesses will be spun off, therefore raising capital and paring down debt. And also overall, I think the overall objective is really for the newly consolidated businesses to be leaner with then stronger cash flow contributions to the overall business.
Yeah, essentially, I think big question marks will be posed as to what will Sime Darby's core business be post demerger from its plantation and also property IPO, which apparently is still set for by year end. Now, going back to the justification for the merger, I mean, if you're looking at, say, net income, like from 2005 to about 2012, net income for the whole Sime Darby Group as a whole grew by more than about 2.5 times, right? From about 1.7 billion ringgit to peaking in 2012, about 4.1 billion ringgit. Now, since 2012, though, every single year, Sime Darby as a group has seen on-year declines in its net income. Hence, you know, I'm guessing this is you know, a big part of the rationale for unlocking the value, you know, being able to spin off the more profitable units from the less profitable ones.
There was a note of surprise, Brian, in your voice just when you talked about Wahid Omar and his appointment. But is that a surprise considering that Permadaan Nasional Berhad is a major shareholder in Sime Darby?
Yes, that's also perhaps implied that as the mother shareholder, PNB, they probably want to scrutinize the operations and the restructuring of the property unit in a lot more detail. It implies that he's going to, you know, hawkishly watch the opportunity. We have unconfirmed of media sources that says that the inventory within Sime Darby property itself, unsold inventory, is very, very large. So there could be a potentially, and very, very large could be as much as a billion ringgit. So there could be a lot of potential opportunities in terms of unlocking value there.
Okay, also in the crosshairs, according to the Financial Times, Samsung Electronics is on track to report record quarterly profits of some 12.1 billion US dollars or some 51 billion ringgit on the back of booming sales of memory chips and display panels. Now, if this figure is correct, Samsung appears to have overtaken Intel as the world's largest chip maker and surpasses Apple's estimate operating profit of some 10.5 billion US dollars or some 44 billion ringgit for the same period.
So in fact, what this means, and it came as a surprise to me, these numbers, Samsung's income for the quarter would be bigger than the combined operating profits of four major tech companies, namely Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. So really, I mean, and their share prices obviously have jumped 43% this year, trading at just above 2,100 US dollars or just above 9,000 ringgit as of Friday.
So that jump in share prices, you know, that record profits, all in spite of the allegations of corruption that, you know, that are basically plaguing this company right at the top, apparently involving a competitive horse. You know, and potentially, it's competitive horse and bribing the then South Korean president there. You know, but you know, despite all that noise, yet you look at these numbers. Obviously, Samsung is still doing something right. You know, even with the Note 7 explosive scandal, even with even some of their washing machines. Apparently, you know, there was some defects there as well that involved a recall. So, despite all these problems, yet you've got Samsung Electronics still being able to really. You know, set that bar so much higher, surpassing Intel, surpassing Apple. Man, yep. Phenomenal here.
Well, so what about Intel? Since you brought it up, Han, you know, this is a race where you, you know, one day and one week or one month, you'll have somebody leading the other. Or is this suggest something structural? Is Intel on the decline, or can it sort of restructure itself and reclaim the crown?
Actually, Sharad, is on the contrary. So these numbers, yes, while they are really good, really Samsung is riding the wave of the chip industry super cycle. So what has happened is the following. Their DRAM, so to get a little technical, there is a chip NAND for data storage, and there are also DRAMs for RAMs for multitasking and so forth. Now the prices of those have risen for the NAD or NAD chips they've risen 50% this year, and DRAM chips have increased 115% in terms of prices. Mm. So what's happening is it's a classic demand and supply situation. Shortage of supply, increased demand, prices have gone up. So on the contrary to what you said in terms of, is Intel in decline? Not really, because generally the Samsung chip unit focuses on lower margin chips, whereas Intel focuses on higher margin chips.
You know, until now, I thought a DRAM was a unit of currency from the United Arab Emirates.
Yeah, that's dirham.
So, okay, moving on to money, because money is very important, and the money that we're going to be giving away to the Middle East. So this is a story, of course, that keeps on giving. Malaysia's 1 MDB bonds, despite news, of course, of today's payment is steady. And the payments that I'm mentioning have to do with an arbitration payment to Abu Dhabi's sovereign wealth fund. Now, the obligation is only half the amount that 1MDB and the Malaysian Finance Ministry have agreed to make to International Petroleum Investment Company, or IPIC, as settlement. The second payment is due at the end of the year. We know, because this has to do with this rather confusing narrative that was, that was trotted out to explain why money went to the wrong company.
Yes, because they had a very similar name.
Yes. So, but what else do we know from this development, Brian?
So basically, now as you correctly pointed out, from the Malaysian version of events, money went to the wrong entity. The Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund said they never received the money. So as part of the settlement, today there is a half the payment is due, which is something in the region of 603 million or about 2.6 billion ringgit that's due today. And at the end of 2017, there is also the balance of the payment, which is another half of that.
Right. Due. So these payments are in accordance with the settlements to those arbitration proceedings between 1MDB and also IPIC. So that agreement was settled in April of this year, I believe. And this are in relation to the payments on those two bonds issued by 1MDB that are due in 2022. But again, I want to just go back to Macquarie Bank. Nizam Idris, who was quoted in the Bloomberg article here, talking about how the noise from 1MDB is, when it comes to the markets, okay, it's fallen to insignificant levels. That's how he describes it. Also, when you look at the credit default swaps, now credit default swaps are basically this kind of insurance that you take if you think that Malaysia is going to default on some of its debt, right? Now, back in about 2015, I'm looking at the chart right now. It was up at almost 250. Today, right now, it's down to 80.4. In other words, that risk premium that you have on a Malaysian story, that has fallen by about two-thirds to where they are now, to levels not seen since 2014, essentially pre-1MDB era. So a lot of this noise seems to have dissipated here, at least from an investor's and market's perspective.
That's right. Because for the taxpayer, we've paid twice for the same thing.
Yes.
And that's going to impact how monies are spent in the budget. It's coming up in October.
But Sharad, the noise level going down is good for the economy.
Hold on. If I'm not correct, I don't think that's really true as well.
Because the money's lost?
No,
then what
the first time around, that wasn't taxpayers' money. This time around, it's from MOF. But yeah. I'm being signaled.
But but still, the Malaysian
that was investors' purse, money, so right? From the bonds.
So yes. The Malaysian purse is still, 2.6 billion lesser
yeah.
for
okay,
it.
Okay, that's yes. better. Yeah,
isn't that right? Is that true? Okay, so less money is spent on you and me. Okay, we're coming up to the top of the hour. And then, of course, we'll have the opening numbers after the bulletin and more analysis. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.